In Christianity, there is a term called apologetics, and that's just a fancy way to say to make a defense. And Christians use this word to communicate a desire for them to defend their faith. And today on Whiskey in the Writings, we're going to examine whether or not that's actually helpful for Christians. Thanks for joining me. This is Whiskey in the Writings, a place for the skeptic, the seeker, the wonderer, those who believe, but maybe just not like they used to. A place where you can wrestle and ask questions honestly about your faith. My name is Joe Oliver, and for the past couple decades, I used to work in churches as a pastor. And now I'm here with my master's degree in biblical theology to talk to you. And so if you have questions, well, this is your place. Let's get into it. There's a re-emerging trend that's happening in Christianity over the past decade, and it's through the lens of apologetics, this belief and desire that we need to be able to defend what we believe against those who are attacking our beliefs in Christianity, or what we believe in Christianity. And this is getting some steam lately, where I'm hearing more and more, whether it be pastors or Christians, talking about their desire to defend their faith, to defend what they believe. And although I think that's a good thing, you should actually know what you believe. And this is something that we wrestle with on Whiskey in the Writings, this reality of, like, do you know what you believe? And what if the things that you were taught to believe aren't actually the things that are true in regards to what the Bible's actually saying? And so we unpack a lot of that. So we're not unfamiliar with this concept. However, I just wonder if apologetics is actually helpful for Christianity, or is it more harmful? And so I'm excited to unpack this term, apologetics. If you've heard, if you've been to church and you're hearing your leaders talk about needing to make a defense for your faith, I wanna unpack what that looks like and how we ought to understand that today. But before we get into that, we're going to look at our whiskey that we'll be sharing here on this episode. All right, everybody, today we're drinking Heaven Hill. This is not new to the channel, but the bottled in bond Heaven Hill is new to the channel. As you know, I love bottled in bond whiskeys. There's criteria that it has to meet. If you've watched any of our videos, this is not new to you. There's certain periods of time that it has to be aged in a barrel. So this one has been aged for 7 years. It has to be 100 proof or more, which in the case of this whiskey, it is 100 proof. And it's just a delicious whiskey, a little bit punchy and a bit of a bite on the front end. And so I've got today, usually we drink whiskey neat on this channel. I've got an ice, not cube, round, ice round here in my glass. I'm going to go ahead and just pour a little bit in here. And we're going to sip on this today as we have this conversation about apologetics, about defending our faith, about what we believe. And I'm excited to get into this topic because I'm going to have a lot to say about it. I'm drinking out of my Whiskey in the Writings glass tumbler. If you want one, you can go to storiesoftove.com. You can click on the give and you can donate to what produces Whiskey in the Writings, which is the parent company, Stories of Tove, and we'll send you out a Whiskey in the Writings glass for yourself to sip on. But whatever you have in front of you, pour your drink, drink responsibly, and cheers. We're starting out with I'm just saying, because I feel like before we get to the writing section, I want to set the stage to what I think is going on and some of the problems that come with this desire to have an apologetic or a defense of our faith. Now, let me share a little bit of my history with this concept. So I was a youth pastor from the years of 2000 to 2007. I worked in a church full time. I was a youth minister. And during that time, I had a very close and dear friend of mine who worked alongside me. He was the children's pastor at the time at the same church, and we had offices next to each other. And he is just a deep thinker and has an ability to comprehend and wrap his mind around deep theological ideas and concepts. And it was something that he always would challenge me with new ideas and thoughts about my faith. And I credit much of my growth and development, maturity in my faith to Mario. And so if Mario, you're watching, I love you, brother, and I thank you for your contribution to my journey in faith. That being said, one of the things that he did was introduce me to different theological thinkers that caused me to want to learn more and be able to fully understand this system of thinking that I was currently in. Now, a couple things about this. I was a youth pastor. So you would think like, well, Joe, didn't you have all the answers of the Bible? No, I didn't. And that is a fallacy of thinking that we apply to our leaders in most religious systems, is that they have all the answers about everything, and they don't. They're growing, they're learning, they're being challenged. Hopefully they are. In some cases they're not, and that's problematic for other reasons. But I was just a young kid that was trying to figure out. I loved Jesus. I knew enough about the Bible to get me along and to teach. And so I found myself in a place, though, that my faith was pretty shallow. It wasn't very deep. And it took someone like Mario to actually encourage me to go deeper in my faith and to actually understand what I believe. And so that started me on a journey to surround myself with people who think deeply about the Bible, people who think deeply about their faith. And it led me to certain theologians that I just really gravitated to, theologians like John Lennox, theologians like John Dixon, Mike Lacona, at the time, Ravi Zacharias, who was a huge apologist in Christianity in the early 2000s. And so these people, I started to read all of their material and begin to grow and to be challenged in what I believe and how to defend what I believe. Now, if you partner this growing desire in me to want to defend my faith and learn more about my faith, you pair that with what was happening in the culture. And if you grew up in the late 90s and early 2000s, you'll remember, I think it was early 2000s, maybe not late 90s, but there were some trends moving in this direction. And there was a movement called the New Atheists that were pioneered this movement of atheism that was led by Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, these outspoken atheists that seemed to have a bent towards Christianity in particular and trying to erode faith and cause people to question their faith. I read the book, The God Delusion. And this was like in circulation at the time. And so all of these things were coming up. And then, so these attacks on Christianity as being false and almost, they would equate Christianity to child abuse. And so it was these really audacious claims about Christianity and trying to erode the confidence in the Christian faith. So then you pair that with another emerging thing in the culture, in the popular culture, by Dan Brown, who was an author that authored a popular writing called The Da Vinci Code. Maybe you remember, it was a movie about it with Tom Hanks. And The Da Vinci Code was a work of fiction that popularized certain kind of fringe ideas about Jesus that were half based in some historical background. Ideas like Jesus married Mary Magdalene. He was married and had kids. That there were these secret writings that the church tried to hide from the rest of the world and push away. Things like how at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, how Constantine organized through political power the formation of the Bible so that he could rule over the people and have his reign kind of be solidified through the power of the church. And if these tropes and ideas sound familiar to you, and maybe at some point you've actually believed them, just know that like these are not true. They were just these stories that Dan Brown put in this popular writing that became popular enough, even though they were made up on some level, and we can get to that in a little bit, but they were just not true. But it took the world by storm. And so then there was this heightened degree of learning about the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Peter, and what are these writings, and who were the Gnostics, and what is Gnosticism? And then you have on the other end the new atheists who are attacking Christianity. So I build that to say in the early 2000s, there was this huge movement towards defending the faith because it felt like a direct attack on Christianity. And I was right in the middle of it from a local church perspective, where I began to read and study about how to defend my faith against people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And even though I never met them, right, I was never in their field of theological, not even theological, but classical training. Like, I was just a youth pastor in a small city, Boise, Idaho, trying to make an impact with a small group of people in our faith community. But I got entrenched in this whole, like, defending our faith, and to the point where it's like, I started reading books about, like, the formation of the New Testament. I'm reading books on church history. I still have them on my library. I brought one out in one of my other videos, but I've got books like The Historical Reliability of the New Testament. This amazing piece of work right here. I've got books like, what else is in here? I've got the Gospel of Thomas right here. I've read it. It's not as interesting as people may think, but I have it because I wanted to know. I have books like, where else are they? Oh, they're up here. Sorry. The Resurrection of Jesus by Mike Lacana. I have a lot of John Dixon stuff, like A Doubter's Guide to Jesus. I have books on World Religions by John Dixon to try to understand that. How about this? Craig Blomberg, one of my favorite scholars. Craig Blomberg, Can We Still Believe the Bible? This was another book. I pulled all of these things. Here you go. The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. These are all things that I pulled together in order to know how to defend the things that I believe. How did we get the Bible? Where did the Bible come from? Who wrote the New Testament? How can we trust that the writings that we have in the New Testament are the writings that we should have in the New Testament? That's a lot of me just throwing out there. I spent quite a bit of time learning how to defend my faith, and I got pretty good at it. I was able to stand my ground with defending, you know, things like, you know, well, Constantine at the Council of Nicaea, he's the one that chose what books were going to be in the Bible and what books are not in the Bible. False. Not true. Not true at all. The only topics of conversation at the Council of Nicaea were about who Jesus was. And so this has been documented. Just there's no scholar out there that believes that Constantine pulled together the bishops of the third century to try to formalize what the Bible was going to be and then mass produce. It just didn't happen. Okay. So what I am saying, though, is that through this lens of defense, defending my Bible, I lost touch of something very important. I lost touch of the ability to actually know how to communicate with people outside of trying to prove that I'm right. And so when I hear people talk about, like, we got to have apologetics, a defense of our faith, people who stand on the corner and want to just debate everyone to prove their point is right, which is what sometimes apologetics becomes. It becomes something that is more about arguing that you're right than actually understanding why someone thinks differently than you, right? For apologetics in these early 2000s, it was all about having the right answer. The right answer according to whatever my theological training led me to believe and that I wanted to reaffirm, which was a lot of my ministry, was just like, what did the Assemblies of God teach me and how do I reaffirm that, from dispensationalism to rapture theology and all my left behind people, right? If the rapture happened this past week and you're still here, cheers. Okay, that's a little dig. I'm sorry for that. Things like these concepts that emerge in Christianity, not from a historical Christian perspective, but actually from a 19th century and 20th century theological frameworks, these things of like proving that I'm right. This was the point of apologetics, to know what I believe so that I can prove someone right. And the crazy thing that I'm seeing in current Christian streams right now, and trajectory of Christianity right now, is a reemergence of this desire. There's a reemergence that there's this is the belief system. There is a blatant attack on my faith. Thus, I need to equip or myself or others in how to defend themselves against the onslaught of attack that's coming their way. And the reality is, okay, here's that. In the early 2000s, there were scholars like the aforementioned Dawkins and Hitchens that had an attack on Christianity, for sure. And there are those people out there that want to destroy Christianity. I mean, that's there. But the challenge is that we hype ourselves up into a frenzy to think that's around every corner, when the reality is most people that are around you that don't have a Christian framework, which is hard to find, right? Let's be honest. When's the last time you talked to someone that didn't grow up in a Christian church, okay? That didn't have a Christian background or a Christian framework? It's so widespread in American culture today, Christianity, that it's really actually hard to find people these days that haven't been impacted by a Christian church somewhere. The reality is that, I'll tell you this, most people don't care what you believe. Hard to hear that. Most people don't care what you believe as long as you're a good person, right? If you're out there running around, running your mouth, condemning people to hell, calling them sinners, telling them they're the worst thing ever, and if they don't repent right now, they're going to burn forever in a fiery furnace, right? That's when people get upset and just go like, I don't want anything to do with that. But the truth is, if you're someone who is kind, respectable, honest, good, they don't care what you believe. So this belief system, this false narrative that we have in our minds, that if we don't actually know what I believe and can defend it chapter and verse, we're going to lose our faith altogether, is actually untrue. It's actually, if you stop and think about it, how many times have you had someone in your life approach you out of the blue without any relational context to you and start attacking your Christian faith? When has that happened to you? I know for me, I've been a Christian all my adult life and my late teenage life. Never have I ever had someone come up to me and go, your belief is stupid and the Bible is stupid. Never. I've had people challenge my points of views on the Bible, and oftentimes that comes from church people, not the outside. Those who are not in the church don't care what you believe. They're asking you not to be a jerk, but they don't care. And so there's an element here that asks the question, why do we feel the need as Christians to fight so hard to defend our faith? And I do think there's some places in the Bible that seem to lead us down this path where we need to stand on the corner and preach. However, I don't think that those things mean what we think they mean when we read them. And we're going to unpack that in a second. The last thing I'll say about, I'm just saying, regarding Christian apologetics. The question we got to ask ourselves when we are trying to defend our faith. One, did this person ask us to? Right? Are they even interested in knowing why you believe what you believe? And if they are, is the way that we're doing it something that's going to lead to fruitfulness? When I'm around apologists, Christian apologists, people that want to fight for what they believe, they often are the people who are the loudest, most staunch, sometimes mean, disrespectful, unkind people communicating the faith. And that should not be the way it is. When we are people who can communicate our faith in such a way that the fruitfulness of it, what comes out of that, is healthy dialogue, people that can communicate in kind and in safe ways. But Joe, they're attacking us about our faith. Okay, hold on a second. Who's attacking you? Stop for a second. Stop believing what the media is throwing at you and what your social media feed is telling you. Who in your life is actually attacking you? My argument is that it's probably no one, right? It's probably no one. Maybe you have an outspoken uncle that goes, oh, Christianity's stupid. Okay? Maybe. Maybe there's a grandfather that's going like, yeah, you know, faith in Jesus is ridiculous. It's not true. At which case, if that's true for you and you have that person, the next question you got to ask yourself, are they looking for a fight or are they inviting me into honest conversation? Okay? Because here's the thing. For those that don't know, I did not grow up a Christian. I became a Christian when I was 15. My family, at the time that I became a Christian, my middle school and late elementary years of my life, I became a Christian at 15 when I, the summer before I went into high school. My family were not Christians. They have almost a theistic worldview, like that maybe a God exists. Maybe they're more agnostic. I'm not sure that they would say they're fully atheist. However, they were not friendly to Christianity. In fact, the book that I showed you, this is my Gospel of Thomas. And I hold on to this. Some people might go like, why do you have the Gospel of Thomas? It's a Gnostic writing. It's heretical, or whatever you want to say about this. I hold this for a couple reasons. One, I think it's important to read. You need to know, well, you don't need to know, I guess, but I think it's important in my theological training to know what the writings are that happened around Christianity, Gnostic writings like the Gospel of Thomas. And there's a lot here that you can learn about early Christianity. There's not a lot you can learn here about Jesus. That's my argument. I don't think you can learn anything about Jesus from the Gospel of Thomas. I do think you can learn a lot about what's happening in early Christianity by reading the Gospel of Thomas. That being said, I have this little book. And the reason why I have this little book is because my grandfather, who is not with us anymore, who was someone that I wish I had gotten to know better in my youth. I was scared of him. He was a military guy. He was in the Air Force and served in the Korean Wars. He just was not an easy guy. And he had a lot of thoughts about faith. And so when I became a Christian, and I started getting into a place of like knowing my faith, he bought this book and gave it to me. This book came to me from my grandfather, and he said, oh, you think you know Jesus? Have you ever read the Gospel of Thomas? And he gave this to me. At the time, I was too young to understand the implications of what he was doing, but he was trying to influence me on some degree in good faith. He wasn't being a jerk. He wasn't going, you're so stupid, here's this, now your faith is meaningless. He was saying, Joe, you think you know the story, but maybe there's more to the story than you think. Now, to this day, I don't agree that the Gospel of Thomas gives us anything useful about the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus. It offers us something else historically. However, he was in good faith trying to invite me into a conversation that I wish in my youth, you know, I'm 16 years old, I don't know any better. I'm trying to figure this Christianity thing out myself. But I look back and I think that was a good faith conversation. When you're in an environment where you have people in your life that are just pushing your buttons, they're just trying to start a fight, those aren't worth engaging. And you can go into your apologetics, but you're just going to aggravate the fight. You're going to make it worse. If you do have someone in your life that's actually genuinely interested to understand why you believe, that's when we begin to engage with our story and the story of the Bible. So that being said, what we have here in the Bible about how we ought to deal with our faith and communicating to outsiders our faith, well, that's what we're going to look at next here in the writings portion. So let's do that right now. Okay, folks, I've got a few things here that I'm going to open up in preparation for this. So I have a few key verses I want to pull out of the New Testament, and I want to talk about these verses. And then we're going to land on a story about Paul at a time where he was in Athens and what happened in that situation. So we'll read that live here. But there are verses in the Bible that indicate how the early church community ought to engage with the society around them. So, a couple caveats we need to understand when we're reading pastoral letters in the New Testament. These are like the Peter writings, the Paul writings, much of the Paul writings, the writing James, the writing Hebrews. These are writings that are trying to help communities of Christians wrestle with and engage with their faith in a context of a world, the Roman Empire in particular, that doesn't understand them and in some cases is hostile to them. So the conditions by which these writings that you have in your New Testament were produced is from an underdog perspective, which this is really important for us to wrap our minds around. Because whether you think this or not, Christians today argue from a position of power, okay? You have power in ways that the earliest first Christians never imagined, I think, that we would ever have today. And so when the writings of these letters and documents were produced and put together, and the reason why they were shared so widely, which allowed them to be collected into what we call our New Testament, is because they were encouragements in how to live in a land that was against their very ethics and morals that they believed their leader and King Jesus asked them to live under. And this caused tension with their neighbors. And so these writers like Peter and I have Paul, it's basically Peter and Paul, they're trying to help these early Christians know how to engage the world around them. And so you have statements that come out of these, and this is what we're going to unpack. But the key thing here I think we need to remember, which is really important, the posture by which they are engaging with those who are not Christian is not for a posture of power or authority, but in humility, knowing that they're the underdogs in the story. They were not in positions of power at this time. And so you have writings like this. You have 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. So 1 Peter is the back of your New Testament, the first chapter, or the third chapter of that, verse 15. And it says this, "But set Christ apart as Lord in your hearts and always be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks about the hope you possess." Okay, so right out of the gate, at first glance, you go like, oh yeah, see Joe, apologetics. You need to be able to give an answer. There's a difference in this. Did you catch the part where he says to give an answer to anyone who asks? All right. So this is the dilemma in apologetics, right? Most people that are pro apologetics want to be the ones shouting the information before anyone even asked. So the question you got to ask yourself is, are you living in such a way that people are even asking you what you believe? Or are you just shouting at them what you believe without them even asking? This is the dilemma. This is why I think the question at the top was like, is apologetics harmful to Christianity? And if you lead apologetics through the lens of just shouting what you believe before someone asks, I think the answer is yes. I think it is problematic because all you do is come off as a jerk, some blowhard that thinks that they know how to tell other people how to live. The real ethic of Christianity at the the base of where Christians began to operate was that they modeled a lifestyle that was so radical that people asked them questions. And so the challenge I got to ask you that wants to just go, I got to know what I believe so I can tell everyone about it. The real question is like, no, what's more important is how you live so that the people will ask you why you're different, why what you, how you responded to that situation, how you responded to your boss, how you responded to your enemy, how you love someone that was different from you, what you did that was so different that they go, tell me, help me understand why you believe what you believe. This, I think, is like the central place that we ought to be when we talk about our faith. It should not come from I'm standing at a corner and I'm just blasting out my two cents on whatever situational, cultural situation that I'm frustrated with or whatever, or to think that like I'm being attacked on all levels when the reality is you're not. Live a life worthy of a question. Live your life worthy of someone asking you a question. That's the call of Christianity. That your life is so like Jesus that people are compelled to come and go, help me understand. Help me understand. Because I wouldn't have done it that way. And then we share. There are other verses like in Colossians chapter 4. This is Paul now. So that was Peter, 1 Peter being Peter. Colossians now, Paul, in chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, he says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders. Okay, so now we have, Paul's like, you have a circle of people around you that are not believing what you believe. So act with wisdom. This is huge. Paul's encouraging the community in Colossae to be wise about how you act around other people, okay? He goes on to say this, making the most of opportunities. Well, what opportunities? That could be a number of things. Let your speech always be gracious. Okay, for my apologist friends that want to stand on the corner and defend what they believe against whatever onslaught that you think is coming your way towards your faith, are your words gracious? If not, you are not following the Christian mandate, the Christian ethic of how we communicate with people. You are to be gracious. And if your words are not gracious, what you're doing is suspect. Okay, he goes on to say this, seasoned with salt. Oh, so Joe, that's the part where I get to get them, with seasoned with salt, right? No, it just means that what you say is flavorful. Think about seasoning with salt, right? What do we season salt with? It's to preserve, and it's also to bring flavor. And in the ancient world, to season with salt is to make something flavorful. And so are the gracious words you're saying attractive and flavorful? Is it something that compels people to enter into what you're talking about, or does it repel them? Okay? So that you may know how you should answer everyone. So there's a reality that if you're living your life, if you're living the ethic of Jesus, it should be compelling enough for people to ask questions. And you should be ready with graciousness and seasoned with salt, answering them when they ask. Titus chapter 1, verse 9, we got a couple more. It says this, so Titus is a writing by Paul, writing to his friend Titus. He's talking about leaders in the church. So this is about leadership. This isn't about common people just exercising their lives, living their lives around other people that are different than them. It's talking about a leadership. He must hold firmly to the faithful messages that has been taught so that he will be able to give exhortation in such healthy teaching and correct those who speak against it. So again, this is about those in the church. This isn't about those outside the church. Titus is not dealing with outsiders where it says correcting those who speak against it. It's talking about those on the inside, that if I have a Christian that wants to sit down and have a conversation about my views on Genesis or Revelation or whatever, that I can actually be someone that can hold faithfully to the things I've been taught and actually communicate that wisely to someone that is challenging those ideas inside my Christian faith, not outside of it. So this is not an excuse to sit and correct people that don't hold to the same viewpoints and value systems that I have. Lastly, I'll say this. In Acts chapter 17, you have an interesting story about a guy named Paul. This, for me, is probably the most compelling story that would advocate someone going into public spaces and engaging in dialogue with other people that think differently. It's Acts chapter 17. Let me caveat this with a prelude to why Christians felt the need to go outside of their own community to share their faith. One, it was because Jesus said, go into all the world, preach the gospel, preach the good news of the kingdom of God, baptizing people in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So there is an explicit command of Jesus to take this message and to share it with those around them. First to Judea, Samaria, and to the other uttermost parts of the earth. So there is a command to go out. And the church, early church, took that seriously. They sent out missionaries like Barnabas and Paul. Peter went out from time to time to share the message of Jesus to those who were on the outside. Okay, there's a key difference between what I believe is happening with that and what we're going to see in Paul in Athens and what modern apologists seek to do. Modern apologists seek to go into public sectors to defend their faith, to protect what they believe is true. What the early church was doing through Barnabas and Paul and others like them was to simply share their faith, so that they can invite people into the beautiful gospel message of Jesus. There's a motivation difference. There are apologists out there that are seeking to debate and argue to prove themselves right or to defend what they feel like is an attack on their faith. No one was attacking early Christianity. They were misfits. They were outsiders. And the attacks didn't come until later when they felt like these Christian lifestyles were actually impacting the Roman Empire and causing a threat to stability of social order. That was why persecution happened in the early church. Was not because they thought that, you know, well, it's dangerous to believe that Jesus was Lord. Persecutions happened in the early church in the Roman Empire because they were weird. They were outcasts and they were disrupting the social order of their day by their lifestyle. Not because of what they were saying, but because of how they lived, it was causing a disruption. And that confusion of how they lived and the disruption that caused this mix of outbreak of persecution that happened in the first century. So there are differences between what we see in modern apologists trying to defend their faith, going into public sectors and arguing with people, versus what we see the early church doing when they would do missionary efforts. And so you have this story, and I just want to read it to you as we close out, because I think it's compelling. Nonetheless, it says this: while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was greatly upset because he saw the city full of idols. So he was addressing the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles in the synagogue and in the marketplace every day, those who happened to be there. Also, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. And some were asking, what does this foolish babbler want to say? Others said, he seems to be the proclaimer of foreign gods. They said this because he was proclaiming the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took Paul and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are proclaiming? For you are bringing some surprising things to our ears. So we want to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there used to spend their time in nothing else than telling or listening to something new. And then it goes into verse 22. So Paul stood there before the Areopagus and said, and then he goes on to proclaim the message of Jesus. talking about how they have an inscription to an unknown God, and he begins to correlate that this God is actually known through the person of Jesus. Beautiful message. There's a couple key points here, because I think a lot of those who are in apologetics lean on this story of Acts 17 and Paul in Athens at the Areopagus to say, we need to go into the marketplace. There's a couple things that happen here. Did you notice that his heart was moved to share the message of Jesus? Okay. It wasn't about, I got to defend. These people are attacking my faith. Now I got to defend it, which is what apologetics is rooted in. This is about a sincere desire to help people understand this is what Jesus did. This is who Jesus is, and I want to tell people about it. Then it actually arose suspicion by the Athenians to actually bring him into the Areopagus, which was a high hill in Athens where all the philosophers would come together and they would dialogue and debate about their different philosophies. And they invited Paul into that. And it was at that point that they wanted to understand, help us understand why you believe what you believe, because this seems weird to us. We've never heard anything like it. So the motivation of Paul is genuine in that he wants people to understand who Jesus is. And he first goes to his fellow countrymen who would have been Jewish in descendancy, or Gentiles who had converted to Judaism. That's where he started. And it was there that the outside Greek culture asked him to come in and actually help them understand what they believe. And it says after this that some believed and some didn't. So there's this reality of, like, even after he defended, he shared who Jesus was, that not everybody believed. And some did and some didn't. So here's the key. The key theme that I think I'm finding in Scripture that I want to compel those who feel like they have to defend their faith. What I am not saying is that you shouldn't know what you believe. Okay? That's important. You actually should. You should know what you believe, because if you don't know what you believe, someone else is going to tell you what to believe and you'll believe it. So you need to know. And hopefully this channel is helping you wrestle with that. Okay? Helping challenge you with that. But secondly, right? This idea of apologetics is harmful to Christianity, because the root motivation is out of fear, attack, that the other is coming at me, and I must at that point defend what I believe because there's someone coming at me. And it's driven in this cultural, this like Christian culture that says the enemy out there is attacking you through people, and so you got to be able to defend your faith, instead of seeing people as image bearers who you have an opportunity to through your life, and maybe if they invite you, your words, to be able to share the reason why you have hope in Jesus. So I'll end it with this. You know, if you're like, maybe you've skipped this whole thing and you're like, I don't know, Joe, apologetics, not my thing, who cares? Apologetics was really important to me. And I know it's important to a lot of people. And there are churches today that feel like there's an attack against them and their faith. Thus, if they don't defend their faith, they're going to lose their faith. And I just want to encourage you with this. If there's anyone we can look to understand the attitude we should have for our current day and age of whatever, you know, belief that there's an attack on your faith, you can look at the New Testament and you can look at the example they set. And what you're not going to see, is argument. What you're not going to see is a fight. What you're not going to see is them beating down their enemies with their beliefs. What you will see is a challenge to be gracious and kind. What you will see is that you are to love your enemy like yourself. So with that, I want to encourage you, love people well, have conversations, be invited into the conversations before you feel like you need to offer your point of view. And I want to thank you for watching this episode of Whiskey in the Writings. Please like, subscribe if it's something that's helpful to you. Share it with someone else that is in your circle that might need to hear this information. And I really appreciate you spending time with me here. And we'll see you next time on Whiskey in the Writings. Cheers.